morning.
Welcome back. I know. You all haven't seen each other for a long time, I can tell. Okay, let's begin. I hope that you all have found on your chair this prayers from the Celtic tradition. I thought it would be a good way to spend the last half of our time together to take a look at this, because it is something that you can take home and carry on for yourself. For many years now, I've done off and on retreats using these to invite people to think about their own dailiness and imagine, having looked at these prayers, how to write a prayer or have a prayer in your head that's simple enough to say while you're making your bed, while you're making your coffee, while you're brushing your teeth, because this may be the only way we're going to pray, you know? That just may be. So I want to share this partly because of that, but also because I think it does give great example of the lifestyle in that part of the world at the time. So if we can imagine now that these were the prayers that were taught by the grandmothers to the children, to the grandchildren, over generations, and they've been passed down, and they're still available to us now, thanks to Carmichael. So in the morning, this would be the prayer, washing. The palm full of the God of life, the palm full of the Christ of love, the palm full of the Spirit of peace, triune of grace. Simple, lovely, but connecting God to the water, Christ to the water, Spirit to the water. This way you don't forget. You do it every day. You know, this is the this is my theology. It's saying to myself, this is what I believe, that God is in this. See, this is why it's helpful to have these. And then we know that it was probably the woman who got up early and made the fire, to kindle the fire. So this is a woman's prayer for kindling the fire. Now the men were doing other things. Yes. And we'll get to them. But this wonderful prayer is such a lovely example of this elemental connection to fire. I will kindle my fire in the morning, in the presence of the holy angels of heaven, in the presence of Ariel of the loveliest form, in the presence of Uriel, of the myriad charms, without malice, without jealousy, without envy, without fear, without terror of anyone under the sun, but the holy Son of God to shield me, without malice, without jealousy, without envy, without fear, without terror of anyone under the sun, but the holy Son of God to shield me. And then she shifts. God, kindle thou in my heart within a flame of love to my neighbor, to my foe, to my friend, to my kindred all, to the brave, to the knave, to the thrall. O Son of the loveliest Mary, from the lowliest thing that liveth to the name that is highest of all. We begin to get it when we hear these, I think. I turn up the thermostat, you know. It's hard to make the connection. But I think we can make the connection. We work at it. But I also love the bed-making prayer because she goes through her history, the history of her whoever's going to share this bed. In the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, they were almost always Trinitarian. They always had some connection to the Trinity. So when you write your own prayer, as long as it has that, it's Celtic. In the name of the night we were conceived. How often do we think of that? I never had when I made the bed, so I just thought of it. In the name of the night we were born, the day we were baptized, In the name of each night, each day, each angel that is in the heavens. I absolutely hate making the bed. And so I thought about this prayer as a help, you know, for that. I can actually cause it to be sacramental if I work on it. But this one, I think, is very important. This prayer that they taught to their children for getting dressed. We don't have any prayers like that. The priests have prayers like that. Remember? Say that louder, don't
When they put on women's clothes.
When they put on women's clothes. But it is wonderful to think about prayers for getting dressed. We all have to get dressed. And that's one thing we know we do every day. Most of us, some days. Maybe not. But, you know, putting on and giving me worship with my whole life, giving me assent with my whole power, giving me praise with my whole tongue, I'm giving me honor with my whole utterance, I'm giving me love with my whole heart. Years ago, when I worked to start the community kitchen, which began at Trinity Church with a simple soup kitchen, we had aprons that we used, and we would give them to the volunteers. There were 16 churches. Many of you were involved in that project. But one day, I realized as I'm putting on my apron, I've seen the priest do this. You know, I thought, why not me, you know? So I taught the volunteers that day, here's what we're going to do. These are our vestments. These are our sacred garments. We are kissing them and giving thanks for that. And so we did it. You can do it. You can do it in any way you want. In the privacy of your own home, you can do prayers for getting dressed. I want to just make sure that we cover these next two prayers and then we'll talk. But this milking prayer, now that we know a little more about Bridget, these women, obviously, you know, they really didn't see any separation between the saints and themselves. They were all around. They could call on them at any point. It was like a lot of household help. Mm-hmm. So here she is. Come Mary and milk my cow. Come Bridget and encompass her. Come Columba the benign and twine thine arms around my cow. Come Mary virgin to my cow. Come great Bridget the beauteous. Come thou milkmaid of Jesus Christ and place thine arms beneath my cow. Isn't that wonderful?
It is.
And then when she gets ready to churn the butter, she needs a lot of help. Come now, Bridget, handmaid calm, hasten the butter on the cream. And you can kind of feel the you know. Seest thou impatient Peter yonder, waiting the buttered bannock, white and yellow. Come now, Mary, mother mild, hasten the butter on the cream. Seest thou Paul and John and Jesus, waiting the gracious butter yonder?
They aren't helping. They're just waiting.
They're waiting, obviously. All right. But now here's the prayer that the men would pray for herding for the cows. Close to you be you, to you be every pit. Smooth to you be every hill. Snug to you every bare spot beside the cold mountains. The sanctuary of Mary Mother be yours. The protection of Mary Mother be yours. The fellowship of Bridget be yours. The fellowship of Michael Victorious be yours. In nibbling, in chewing, in munching. So you just love it. Oh. Well, I want to have time to hear from you about what this evokes for us. And what you, I'm sure that many of you have traveled to these sacred sites in the world and have had some experiences of your own. So for as much time as we have, let's see what you bring to this conversation before we stop.
Oh, and I thought the herding prayer, it came to mind about when you were having your family comes to visit you and coming for a meal. You can honestly think of it that I could anyway.
Oh, yes.
That way, you know, be safe on the road.
Nibbling, chewing, and munching ideas. I love them. It could be a break. It could be a blessing. It could be a lot of things. Thank you. Did you all hear that? That she said that she could see this prayer, this hurting prayer, useful when her family comes together from all over the place for a meal and when they go away. So this would be, you know, they come to nibble, chew, and munch, but they also...
Or you're trying to get
them
in for dinner.
That's another one. Yes.
I think one of the things that was going on inside of me is inspiration for something I already know deep within, but I do not have practice of in this manner. But what a wonderful day. I mean, it was just inspiring to think that everything, obviously, is his, you know, his stuff.
Yes, yes.
And that we can experience trusting him with everything, giving everything over in little spurts throughout our day, you know.
Yes. It's, yes, this is the concrete example of practice. But what's wonderful about what you said, she said that it was good for her to realize that she carries this within her already and just doesn't have a chance to practice it. This was the Pelagian heresy, you know, that we have it, that it's our source, that God is there, that we don't need an outside hierarchy to help us with that. That we have it, and we have it in the natural world. So that's heretical. Yes.
And I couldn't help think of our own Native Americans,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now they were fierce,
mm-hmm.
but yet they have an artistic side.
Yes.
Weaving and sand cultures. And
yes.
Such. They also were fierce when they had to do it. And they also invoked their ancestors as they did the grandparents, you know, they bring them in. And they also did not separate matter from spirit.
Yes.
Otherwise, everything
yes.
was sacred.
Yes.
And filled with the spirit.
Yes. So, many similarities.
I'm sure if I put more, I could think of more parallels.
Oh, I think absolutely.
It's original. It's especially intriguing because they were primitive societies,
both
of them.
Yes, yes. When Esther DeWall, who's written so many things and who has been a great source for me in doing this work, when she came to America to visit and she came to my house to stay with us at one point, and she talked about this, that she had been over to Santa Fe, and she said, this is amazing, you know, there's so many similarities. And so she'd begun to read some of the American Indian lore and found it very much the same. We can find it in our own land.
I haven't done much work, but enough to be curious, paralleling most of the Aborigines in Australia.
Oh, I think so. I think that it is the deep wisdom that human beings come with, you know. And if we can hardly ever find a pure source of it anymore. But I think it's that part of it.
I want to make a tie-in with some of the other sources we've had here, especially those from Marcus Ball.
Yes.
Where he built his work on the Jesus Seminars, the different layers of historicity of the synoptics, basically. And one of his important themes is the theme that Christ did not come to save us from sin. You know, the yes. propitiation and yes. all of that kind of thing, which I think lines up very well with this notion that Pelagius really got us on that, you know.
Yes.
But that in looking at the earliest levels of the synoptics, they do not have that theme.
Yes. Yes. Did you all hear that? Dawn said that this ties in with some of the things that you've done in the past, that you've read, Marcus Borg specifically. In his work on the Synoptic Gospels and the way, and what he says is that Jesus in those Gospels, in the earliest sources, if you go down far enough, it's not about Jesus needing to come and save us. It's not propitiation. So that's, there are a lot of things that fit here. It's wonderful to reclaim things for ourselves. Martha.
Well, I think another interesting thing about wages that got him in trouble was he educated women in Rome.
Yes, that really was a big deal. Yeah. Yes.
And when that comes out of the county where women always were held in higher esteem, certainly with these double monasteries and so forth.
Yes. Now that was one of the big problems for Pelagius, that he had a very different view of women. So it's really interesting to see how that carries over. Yes.
When you were talking about water, it reminded me, quite a while ago I heard a debate on NPR about water, and one group saying water is a commodity, and they were the ones buying up watersheds. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the only way to get water is to buy it from them. Mm-hmm. And the other group, I don't remember the exact words, was saying, no, water has a sacred quality, it belongs to all people. First group said, well, we can't bother with that. That gets in the, it's an obstacle to profits.
Mm-hmm.
You start thinking that
way. Yeah. Keith is talking about something that he heard on NPR about two views of water. One is a commodity and one is a sacred source that should be available to everybody. And the last part of that was, well, no, we can't have that. It gets in the way of profit. Yes, Teresa.
Talking about St. Bridget reminded me of the greetings in Ireland still in Gaelic go, Dia good, God be with you. And the reply is, Dia's wirra good, God and Mary be with you. And if you want to take it a little further and say, Dia's wirra good is Padraig. And then that's God and Mary and Patrick. And then the side of that is, Dies Virgo, the Padraic is Greed.
Yes, so she comes in there. Did you all hear that?
Well,
that's lovely, thank you. And it's wonderful to hear the language, isn't it? Yes. Yes.
I think it was Augustine that really gives Pelagius in, because Augustine spent the last 13 years of his life in debate with Pelagius. And Augustine, because of his own sense of depravity, especially about the sexual part of his life, felt there was nothing good in him because his conversion came by sheer grace, that his idea was there isn't anything good in the human, that it's all grace. And so, rather than, and back in those days, I don't think they knew how, everything had to be black or white.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know how to hold that tension.
No, that's true.
And so I think if Augustine's doctrine of original sin came mostly because of his argument with Pelagius, and so that's where he got the Malthus and Prada, that human is just a mass of defective clay. Even babies are condemned to hell.
Yes.
He has statements about that.
Yes.
And so, once you go back in history and you look at the person, and Augustine really struggling with himself, and Pelagius and where he was coming from, it gives you permission to make your own decision about those things. There wasn't a historical winner and a historical loser in that debate.
No.
Obviously, Augustine won out.
Yes.
And the other thing that was rising up in me as you were speaking is the tremendous power of presence when you're present to what you're doing in the daily thing. And, I think in our history, which is so complex, we've gotten away from the sacredness of the ordinary because we have a sacramental system that says sacraments hold all the grace, and actually they point to the sacredness of all of life, but we have taken them alone to say this alone is sacred. So there's this otherworldliness and this sacramental system in the church that doesn't allow us to see that every meal is the Eucharist.
Yes.
And that every moment of forgiveness is a sacrament of reconciliation. And that kind of thing.
Yes.
the
yeah, absolutely. It's really amazing what difference it makes when you start practicing this. Last year, my husband was very sick, came close to dying in the summer, and I was at Cottage Hospital for weeks on end. And I began at first to think I was going to lose my mind. And then I realized, well, no, I could actually practice what I know. And it really saved me. And it was that. It was being present in the moment, mindful of every single thing, so that I was afraid if I did it at first, that then I wouldn't be able to keep track of these six specialists who didn't speak to each other and the 12 medications that the nurses were mixing up. You know, all that was going on. I was supposed to be the advocate. You've all been in that spot probably. So, but it didn't. It actually cleared my head, which is amazing. So I highly recommend this kind of mindful practice because it really works. And it does, as I'm getting older and becoming more forgetful, I don't know about you, but I spend a lot of time trying to find what I put somewhere just now, you know. And now, if I remember to practice it, I'm not thinking of five things at once. I'm thinking about what I'm doing, and it slows me down enough. I think these prayers are helpful. So when you're making the bed, you're actually putting something into it of the sacred, and you're getting something from here, connected to the task. It really makes a difference. It's transforming us, I think. Yes.
This is an observation. The practice of being mindful and focused is wonderful as I get older, but it's not complementary to my driving on the freeway.
No, I don't do it when I drive. Although, it is helpful to pay attention to where you're going. Yes, Jane.
I actually have had a different experience. If I don't switch on NPR in the morning or music in my car, I am much more likely to thank God for a beautiful day and, you know, and make a little quiet meditation. And I was going to say, silence really goes with this.
So absolutely.
If you've got music blaring or the TV in your house, you probably won't be as inclined.
Well, and I think this tradition, you know, has its kind of hermetic quality about it. You know, it's a contemplative kind of process. Mm-hmm. Came from the Desert Fathers. Well, we know they were pretty contemplative. They were isolated. But they brought this into their own family life. So the wonderful thing that we see here with these prayers and imagining these little houses in Ireland especially, where it was very hard to maintain their life, very hard work. And yet, they had turned the house into a monastery of sorts, you know. They had their rule of life. They were practicing it every morning. They did, you know, when she built the fire. And then at night, you see here at the bottom, there's the banking of the fire at night, calling again on the sacred three to shield, to surround the hearth, the house, the household, this eve, this night, each single night on it. You know, it was just automatic to make that connection in the dailiness of our house. Now, I suspect that, you know, all of us have longed to run away to a monastery or a nunnery or, you know, at some point in our life. Some of us did and came back, but many of us don't imagine how that would be, you know, to be able to live like that. Well, actually, we can. We can. They showed us that you can. That you can live in your own house as if it were a sacred dwelling and create it that way. Keep seeing it that way. Our gardens should be easier. Yes.
Do we know what caused them to be so ferocious? Because it feels like there should be this wonderful harmony. And there's such beauty with all that they see in such traditions. Do we know what caused them to be so terrorized?
Well, they were... I mean, the whole world was like that. It wasn't only the Celts, you know. If you read the history of Greece, Rome, you know, they all had these horrendous battles. So as I said before, the thing that's difficult for us in unraveling who the Celts were is that the writings come from their enemies who were fighting them. And we do know they were ferocious, there's no doubt about it. But they were also, so primitive. And they also, if you have a total belief in the afterlife, you're not worried about losing your life, you will go into a battle full on, you know. And even women fought. They have some great stories about women. Mm-hmm. And we know the story of Boudica, you know, who invaded London and burned it down. Pretty amazing. And there's a great image of her, long red hair, riding a horse, dressed in a garb, and they describe the colors of the... It sounds like a plaid that she's got on with different colors mixed in. Terrific explanation from the people who were there at the time about how ferocious she was. But it's partly the way things were. In order to move ahead, to get what they needed, that's what they did.
I didn't catch her name.
Boudica. Boudicca. Boudica.
Or Boeticea.
Yeah, lots of pronunciations. I actually went online to find the pronunciation, and that was one. I was calling her Boudicca because I thought she was like bodacious.
I believe you said something about the God being within us. I also remember as a child hearing the phrase, Christ in us, hope and glory.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's so wonderful.
Yeah.
Christ is within us. Yeah. We can be Christ. And I don't remember where that came from. It's probably from the Bible.
Yeah.
Anybody
knows? Yeah. Well, it's been in our liturgies, you know. So it isn't that it's been hidden from us, but it's never been popularized. It's always been connected, you know, there's been that split, which happened in many ways. It happened in science, you know, where when I was trained in biology, I really believed that what I was being taught was the truth
mm-hmm.
that had come from hard scientific work. Well, part of it did, certainly, but some of it did not. Some of it came from political, theological issues in the 16th century with the split between the supernatural and the natural. And the church and its hierarchy wanted to keep things supernatural and everything else could be given to the rest of them. But that's the split and that's still going on. So we're still in that tension between those things in many ways. It's beginning to be healed, thank God. We're forced into it. In a lot of ways, in the natural world. Yes.
All right, thank you for being here. It's been great. I wanted to know what you knew about St. Patrick. When I was over in Ireland, I went on the new treasures of Ireland,
yeah.
1998.
Uh-huh.
And I believe he got married later on in life. You don't hear that much about that.
I don't know about that, but there's some wonderful... histories of St. Patrick that are fascinating to read. Now, you know, they're kind of mixed. We never know for sure about some of it. But the wonderful thing about Patrick that I know that Esther Duhall has written about is that, you know, he had been held as a slave for 7 years. And during that time, he was outdoors. I mean, he was stuck. And so he was in the snow, he was in the rain, and in his own and autobiographical stuff, he says that he prayed all day and all night because obviously he was kind of under it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he became much more connected to the elements and to the way in which you can survive with God in you in that situation. I think that's one of the important things about Patrick. But there are many other things.
And he didn't try to change their whole, like, religion. I mean, he just brought the pastoral.
Yes, yes. And the other person you might want to take a look at is Aidan, A-I-D-A. Because there's a great story about him. He was the abbot of Lindisfarne. He had missionaries in his monastery who were going out and coming back. And there's a story about one of them going out and telling everybody, you know, teaching the pagans that they were going to hell and that they needed to be saved, essentially. And he wasn't getting anywhere. They weren't buying that. And they weren't joining the Christian church. And so Aidan says to him, I will go, because that is not good news, essentially. So he goes, and he converts lots of them. So that story is pretty telling, you see. He's Pelagian in his thought. And so he tells them that God is in them, that God loves them, that the source of everything is God's love. That's not so hard to buy, you know. We should have learned that a long time ago. Have about 5 more minutes. Anything else, Christine?
Well, I was thinking it sounds like everyone knew at least the maybe at an elemental unconscious level what a treasure their life was, mm-hmm. and if hordes were coming in challenging that, I'd be ferocious in protecting that too.
Mm-hmm.
Defending that.
Yeah. It is hard to know. Why, if the Celts were more ferocious than any other warriors, we don't know that for sure. We know that they were colorful, that's for sure. I mean, anybody who takes off all their clothes and starts screaming and banging, making noise, you know, that's memorable. So we don't really, you know, I don't know. But it's also interesting to know what happened when Christianity came. And that era that's called, you know, the saintly era in the Celtic world, in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, where these Irish saints were so evocative, you know, and they would go around and convert people because they were so peaceful. And so how did that happen? How did that conversion happen? You know? Well, we know that it does happen to us. Some of us have had experiences like that of conversion from an older way of life, a way of being self-centered and competitive and all, to a more communal way of life. And that may be what happened to them. But in any case, that's part of the historical evidence, that there was that period of time. Things were very, very beautiful there. Now, that doesn't mean that they were not, there are also accounts that the ones that we hold up as being the most saintly also carry a spear. And they were willing to use it if they had to. We know that's not the most talked about part of them, but it's there.
Well, the Norse god Wotan always carried a spear.
Yes, the Norse god Wotan. Yeah. So
and,
all,
you know, another thing, he had a black patch over one eye, and the legend is that he gave up his eyesight in one eye for the gift of wisdom.
So there's another stream from the prehistoric culture. Yes, Jack.
As you said something that the saint went around to the Irish people and converted.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me, and I don't have a date on it, but I understand they were an itinerant people.
Yes.
Itinerant bishops.
Yes.
And there was no chance of them.
No, that's right. That's right. They were free.
They
moved
back in 313.
Yeah.
When they aligned themselves with the government, and they've been with the government all along.
Yeah, they've been with the government all along. So that's, you know, it's fascinating to see the difference. And the church that might have been, you know, in my mind, would have had both those things. You know, somehow it would have been able to carry both things. Because we need some organization, you know. And their itinerancy was good for that time. It wouldn't work now. But we can see places where the church could reform herself by picking up some of these ideas from this time. But, yeah, thank you for yes.
I heard a speaker say that cultures or civilizations, a sign of immaturity is their competitiveness, but the sign of maturity in civilizations is when they learn how to cooperate, because that's the only way they really survive.
Yes.
And Elizabeth Arturo, she's an evolutionary biologist.
Yes, yes.
The human body is even that way. But we couldn't even be sitting here talking if all the different organs and systems in our body were cooperating together in order.
Very
to
good example.
She likes to use that, image of what if the northern system, what if the respiratory system decided it wanted control and started to sparkle out oxygen to the other organs. So if we would just learn the lesson of how the human body actually functions as a unit in cooperation, we could probably come to more peace.
Yes. Thank you.
Let's cooperate, guys.
Yes, that's the first. Yeah, Jack is saying that that's the first prayer of the day. Let's cooperate.
I'm just thinking that maybe we as a group are kind of the new itinerant church, because in many ways we are not structured like the traditional churches. We are married priests, we are lay people, we are you name it people, and we're kind of exploring.
Yes, you have freedom.
We have freedom
to explore, and you're using it very well, I have to tell you.
And nobody is pushing
you. Are
us.
Yeah.
We're
yeah.
Strong.
Yeah. And you are going to have the biggest treat when you start reading Teilhard. My goodness.